Well, in Galatians 3, the last part of chapter 3, we had looked with, in all of 3, where Paul begins his kind of argument. The first couple of chapters are clearly building a platform for arguing, presenting his argument about the gospel. In chapter 3, he says, you foolish Galatians, who bewitched you? And he starts talking about the gospel and their changing. Verse 3, he says, are you so foolish, having begun by the Spirit, are you now being perfected by the flesh? And so he approaches them based upon their experience. You started off by trusting Christ, this faith relationship, and now you think it's got to be based on something else to live a Christian life. And then he moves to an argument about Abraham, and basically saying that Abraham's faith was what was when faith, you know, righteousness was attributed to him. So even Abraham came to a relationship with God based upon faith. And then he makes an argument about the law. And we saw that argument continued last week as he looked at it in the sense of the law and connecting it with the promise, that there was a promise. The promise came before the law. The law didn't nullify this promise, and Christ came in the sense of the fulfillment of that promise. And continuing that, in verse 23, he says, but before faith came, we were kept in custody under the law, being shut up to the faith which was later to be revealed. What other translations in place of like a word custody and shut up? Do you have other words? Verse 23. Under guard. Okay. Okay, so you have confined and imprisoned. Sally, you have what, NIV? Okay, you have the, and it says under guard, and this is the updated New American Standard, has custody and being shut up. But and you can see from the different translations that both terms have this idea of imprisonment, being in jail, you know, guarded. Confined, that prior to faith, and here it's, I don't think it's faith in the sense of, well, I don't know, I guess in one sense you would say before faith. When would be before faith? I don't think there could be a time before faith. I mean, you know, with Adam and Eve, there's a sense of faith, right? God gave directions. So it's not, I don't think it's talking about that sense of faith, but we're talking about before the gospel, before this Christ, not the gospel of the Old Testament, because there's always this sense of faith, because we've already established how did Abraham come to righteousness? By faith. So it's not in that regard. I think we're looking at the sense of Jesus Christ. We're talking about not the gospel in the sense of a saving message, the gospel in the sense of the good news about Christ. Before faith came, we were imprisoned, we were guarded, we were in jail, if you would, being shut up to faith, which was to later be revealed. We're in prison under the law. The law was there as a... not, you know, if we think of imprisoned in the sense of... the harsh, you know, I'm in prison. The prison is the dungeon, the mean entity. You know, it's an evil entity. Then that would not be the right view here. But if you think of confined, held in check by, that would be the idea of law here. That's what law did, and it did that until there was faith, which was to be revealed later. So once again, we're not talking about faith in the sense of the ability to trust, because that would have preceded even the law. but this is just being used as a synonym for the gospel. Verse 24, therefore the law has become our tutor to lead us to Christ so that we may be justified by faith. So the law, what was given by Moses, that sense of the law, not just a law, but the law, became a tutor. Well, when I think of the term tutor, it's in that a tutor is that person that you hire in addition to a teacher, somebody to come in and give you that extra advantage, instruction, care, so that you can learn something. So a tutor is that, you know, over and above caring person that provides for you. But that's not the concept of tutor. Okay, that's kind of how we use tutor. And somebody says, oh, this is, you know, my tutor. This is somebody that, you know, a privileged position to have. Well, tutor was in many ways a privileged position. I mean, not everybody had a tutor. But a tutor, I think they said, and I'm not sure if it's in the Living Bible. I suspect, I didn't look it up in the Living Bible. I read this about the author of the Living Bible, that his view of this word was a very strict governess. So tutors were often very harsh on their students. So you'd have to be a fairly wealthy family to be able to afford a tutor. But the tutor was placed in charge of that child's education. But it would be more in the sense, and you know, and this is a disservice to, I'm sure, the many fine nuns that were involved in education. But the stereotype, having never been in a Catholic school, but what you hear in the picture you see, is a very harsh school teacher. You know, one that walked around with a ruler and at every opportunity, even if there wasn't a reason, whack somebody, you know, with the ruler. Well, that's the idea, more the idea of a tutor here. It was one that directed, more of a harsh taskmaster. So in the sense that that's what the law did. The law, there's a sense of harshness to it. But what the law was doing was directing in a way that where the result was that you would be result, you know, that it led you to Christ. That is, the result is that we were justified by faith. I mean, being led to Christ, the idea is that you're justified by faith. But that's what the law was about. So we come up often with a very negative view of the law. You know, when we think of the law, we think of just something that was bad. Well, there's nothing bad about the law. The law is good. The law had a purpose of showing us our failures. But where the law has no value is in saving you. But that wasn't ever its design. But what the law can do is, in that regard, make one aware of their need to lead them to Christ. Now, in some sense, you have to become aware of your need to ever trust Christ. Now, I think there's a little bit of an exception. I'm not really sure how it works theologically. I'm not sure how it works psychologically. You know, with a young child, I'm not sure of the degree that a 8-year-old understands their need. I'm not sure how they process everything to trust Christ. I have no doubts based upon, you know, people's testimonies and stuff that really occurs. But I don't know that all 8-year-olds necessarily come to the point of saying that they have a real sin issue and that's why they trust Christ. I think I mentioned recently that, you know, only an adult would be dumb enough to say, when presented, do you want to go to heaven and walk on streets of gold? Only an adult would say, nah, I'm not buying into that. But if you came to trust Christ later than that, there most likely was some sense of need. And you come to recognize my failure to be able to attain some level of righteousness, some level of need, some level of attainment, and therefore you trust in Christ. Well, the law makes us aware of that. Then he moves on. He says, but now that faith has come. So once again, we're seeing this faith has arrived. So we're seeing in this passage Paul using faith, not so much in trust. It's not so much in the synonym here for trust, but faith in this context, this limited context, is more in the sense of the gospel. That response, the response to God, the whole package tied together. Now that faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor. That is, it's not that the law disappeared, but the law doesn't guide me toward Christ anymore. You could almost think of it in the sense of a map. If you don't know where you're going, the map is your director. But once you arrive, it no longer is your director. Its value isn't in getting you there because you're there. Continue in verse 26, he says, as an explanation for what he's just said, for you all are sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. Now, place this in a context because we become very accustomed to referring to ourselves as children of God and in that regard that we're of this family of God, which is appropriate in the New Testament. But put it in the context that we're, it's a Jew-Gentile mix here, and we've brought in this argument about Jewish heritage, and being a son of God is tied to being Jewish. It's tied to being a son of Abraham. It's connected. And others are more of this, at best, a stepchild. You're coming in from the outside. You can be a part of the community, but you're really always on the outer circle. And Paul says, for all sons of God, and the way that occurs is through faith in Christ Jesus. For all of you who were baptized in Christ have clothed yourself with Christ. For all of you who were baptized into Christ have clothed yourself with Christ. This idea of, clothed yourself with Christ, you put on Christ. That the concept would be, it's a new wardrobe and Christ is your wardrobe. But you've been baptized into Christ. Well, you can see with phrases like that that if one wants to, and I think if one doesn't, want to be real theological and you just want to have your little verses that you can, isolate, the idea of baptismal regeneration, that you got to be baptized to be saved, water baptized, you can see why, where you're going to come up with things and form some arguments. But there's no sense of water in this passage. For all who were baptized in Christ, now I do think that, in the writings here, the idea that there was a Christian that hadn't been baptized in water is pretty non-existent, because that was a rite that, initiation that took place. But it's not the water, the deal here is that if you were baptized in Christ, it's that theological baptism. Baptism in the sense of being identified with Christ. This would be like the sense of the baptism of the Spirit. If you trusted in Christ, then, as he would say in Romans, you've been united with Christ. Then what's happened is you've clothed yourself with Christ. If you've trusted in Christ, if you've become a Christian, then you're so closely identified with Christ. The result of that, in verse 28, there is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free man. There is neither male nor female. For you are all one in Christ Jesus. And there's that sense of, for you're all sons of God. That is, there's no distinction. Once again, I don't think it's possible for us to have a real strong experiential connection to what this passage is saying. Because we've grown up as I assume all, the rest of you, most of us at least, have grown up in the sense of that the normal Christian is a Gentile. Not to exclude Jews, but most of us don't have that history of having grown up with someone that had a Jewish heritage, and that was normal for them to be Christians, and so we had Jews and Gentiles together as Christians. So we just think it, you know, very much. But if you can put yourself in a kind of a position to where, as a Gentile, you were on the outside. You know, the best you ever were was on the outside. Or, it probably, it'll, in you know, other things that make a distinction. Now, you know, maybe in Oklahoma, in Tulsa, maybe it'd be in the sense of, which is pretty hard to imagine. You know, you're not a Sooner, and you're not a Cowboy. You know, you're one in Christ. But that would probably be about the best conflict we, you know, have here. That there's that sense of unity. It says that there's neither. You know, however you want to divide. If you want to divide people in the sense of Jew or Greek, it's not there. Slave or free man, it's not there. Male or female, we're all one in Christ. Now, I don't think that passage, and I think it is incorrect to take this to say there are no distinctions. You know, some will take this from a feminist standpoint and say, well, then there are no distinctions biblically between male and female. So the whole idea of hierarchy or leadership in the church, none of that matters because of this verse. But there really isn't, that doesn't seem to be what it's talking about. It's in the sense of faith and position in Christ, unity. Yes, yes, in the sense of that Jews just, yeah, all that's disappeared. But the sense of unity should be there, not the sense of outsideness. And the law, you know, the law also formed that at times. And so in verse 29 it says, "And if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's descendants, heirs according to the promise." And that's just the connection back to this idea of promise, that the world would be blessed through Abraham. The promise would go through Abraham's seed to the world. That is Christ to the world. That the world would be blessed through Abraham's seed. That's the promise. And if we belong to Christ, then that is who's Abraham's descendants. So, biblically, and from a, I guess, DNA standpoint, you know, if you want to say historically, the DNA standpoint, Abraham's descendants are what we would refer to as Jews. What the Bible would refer to physically in the sense of Jews. Spiritually, however, Abraham's descendants are those who have a relationship with God through the promise, based upon the promise. That it's through his Abraham's seed that they are blessed, through Jesus Christ. And so Paul goes this whole way of talking about promise, goes through this, ends up with the same place of promise, and in the sense of, if you want to argue your position, your privileged position because you're a descendant of Abraham, Paul is almost like, you're exactly right. However, let's be clear that the descendant of Abraham, the son of Abraham, the child of Abraham, isn't necessarily one that's his child physically. It's the one that's his child through this sense of promise. And so, we're his descendants, that is, his heirs, not according to DNA, but his heirs according to the promise. And so you're back to this whole, the whole sense of faith, that all of this is tied together. Of course, he's argued here in the sense of using faith almost as a synonym of the gospel, but also earlier faith has been used in contrast to working, that the relationship, you know, righteousness, this relationship to God doesn't isn't attained by something we do, per se. It's attained by what Christ did in our relationship to Christ. And our relationship with Christ is in the sense of being so identified with Christ that we put on Christ, and it comes through the promise. And in the context of what Paul has said prior to this passage, not so much he's saying in this passage, verse 26, he says it, it's through faith in Christ. And so even in verse 26, it's obviously using faith different than he was using it in the verses above it. And so when we think of who we are spiritually, who are we? We are connected all the way back to God's promise to Abraham that the world would be blessed through his seed. That is the Messiah. And that preceded the law. Now, we, you know, like I said, I don't think we experientially have a real tight connection there, because I don't think any of us probably grew up thinking we were under the law, per se. But from time to time in groups, even within Christian circles, there's this sense of you have to keep the law. You have to do these things. And so when you start thinking about other things you could bring in, you know, people that argue about baptism, for instance, because, you know, and there are some passages in the Bible that would seem to suggest that you have to be baptized to be saved. But there are many, many more that are clearly not that. And I think part of the reason is the connection between water baptism and being saved were so close, because they just occurred at the same time, almost. But if you were to think about that, which came first, water baptism or the promise? So even if Paul would almost, you know, I don't know that he would, but he could use the same argument about water baptism as he's doing about the law here. That water baptism came to be a sign that we're believers. Water baptism came after the promise, so he cannot nullify the promise. The promise precedes the law. The promise precedes everything. And it really becomes somewhat silly when you think about it in terms of coming up with the law and making the law the whole basis of salvation, the whole basis of righteousness, when the law was with Moses, and yet prior to Moses was Abraham. You know, the father of the people was Abraham, not Moses. And the promise was given to Moses, I mean to Abraham, and it was based on faith, and it looked to Christ. So what was the purpose of the law then? Because the promise had already been given. The purpose of the law was to, so to speak, to keep us in check, to keep a boundary around, to put a certain direction on us, leading us to Christ. You know, without the law, would you ever know that you had a need? That becomes somewhat the purpose. Now, I think there's probably ways, I think there were ways that people knew before the law was given through Moses, but it was through other revelation that we're for you. But that gives that direction. And so that's where Paul's argument has moved to this point. Any thoughts or insights? Questions? Yes. That's a good question. I don't know. It's a good question. I've never heard that addressed. Would you? I think in most societies until present Western civilization, you could probably have told that. I'm not positive about Jew and Gentile, whether there was any distinctive way they dressed. that was an indication.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, the Pharisees, that kind of